Hi, Soundarya. Thank you for chatting with me today. Your book, Unshackled, breaks down the many pathways to employment-based immigration in the US today. Not to be confused with employee-based visas, because you have provided a lot of detail about pathways for entrepreneurs and others in the startup world as well. But we all know it's complicated, but let's get to it. You set the stage for your book from the first page at an event in the White House in June 2014, when President Obama was told by Speaker Boehner, almost casually, we're not going to do anything about immigration. I'm not bringing it up to vote. The bill is dead. That moment was a brutal end to 8 months of work by Congress and the White House on a comprehensive immigration bill. The story behind this reversal is politics plain and simple, as President Obama later said, and a complicated one at that, right? Even though everyone in both parties agrees that the immigration system is broken, they cannot build the consensus, nor do they have the political courage, really, to tackle it. From a policy and historical perspective, what did that moment mean for Indians in America who were waiting for a green card or an H-1B lottery approval? What are the holes in the immigration laws that specifically don't favor the Indian immigrant?
Yeah, that was actually such a beautiful and short summary of the whole chapter and what happened almost exactly 10 years ago this time. In terms of what that meant, I don't think people knew the significance of what that meant back then as much as right now, because, you know, right now we have the benefit of hindsight. And looking back 10 years, that is the closest that we've come to actually passing a comprehensive reform bill that not just would have helped Indian immigrants, but also, you know, over 11 million people who have an undocumented status, who don't have a legal status, who could have gotten it if that bill had been passed. But I think the main loophole or the main flaw with the system that disadvantages Indian immigrants is that there's something called country caps, which was instated probably back in the 1990s, when the last comprehensive bill was passed. So at that point, Congress made it such that each country only gets 7% of the total number of green cards available each year. So there are about 140,000 employment-based green cards given out every year. Mm-hmm. That hasn't changed in the last few decades. So people from any one country can only get 7% of that 140,000, which is about, say, 10,000 green cards. But obviously, this disadvantages Indians because, you know, we have more people come from India and China than any other country. I think India and China make up probably half of all the immigrants coming from across the world. So it kind of puts us in this very limbo state of having one leg inside the country, mm-hmm. wherein you're living here, working here, you have a family here, your kids go to school here, but your one leg is always outside because you could lose your job tomorrow and have to move out of the country.
Taking a step back, this book is a comprehensive look at immigration. Tell me your story, your immigration journey, what compelled you to tackle writing this book, as well as your collaboration with your fellow writer and immigration lawyer, Samir.
Yeah, this was very much born out of just personal experiences with immigration. Like many students, or like many Indians, I came to this country to pursue my master's all the way back in 2017, so about 6 years ago. After graduating, I joined Salesforce, which mm-hmm. also, like many Indian students do, joining a corporate job as a product manager. But I figured out within the first year that it wasn't my passion, but I just knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And that's when I think immigration resurfaced again to my mind, because once I realized I wanted to quit my job and do something of my own, that's when I started reading about immigration. I started understanding, so what are the different pathways that I can use to quit my job and become a solopreneur? How can I start something of my own? So all these questions kind of led me down this rabbit hole of understanding how legal immigration works, what are the different pathways for founders. And eventually I quit, or at least I moved my job from Salesforce to this small startup where I was employed, or I'm still employed, mm-hmm. although I'm applying for my O-1 visa as a founder right now. And that's when I reached out to Samir sometime last year, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. Samir helped transfer my H-1B from Salesforce to the startup. So I felt like we had great chemistry when mm-hmm. we were working on that together. So I approached him asking, hey, would you like to write a book on this topic? And fortunately, he said yes, because for his own reasons, he'd been wanting to do this for a very long time. So
in your book, you say it's not about finding the single best option. It's about finding the best option for your specific scenario and needs. I love the simplicity of that statement, because it's in direct contrast to the actual topic of immigration laws in America, which is so convoluted and complex. Probably the most used visa categories for Indians who want to immigrate to the United States to work is probably the pathway of the F-1 student visa to F-1 OPT to H-1B, right? What are the pitfalls yes. for this path, and what works well?
That's a great question. I think the current pitfall is that, you know, the F-1 is an uncapped visa. Anyone who is going to do a master's or bachelor's or PhD will get it. But then once they get the F-1 and eventually the F-1 OPT, where do they go after that? The H-1B used to be a stable option. And, you know, we mentioned this in the book as well. In 2019, for example, when I got my H-1B, I think the chance of getting picked for a master's category was something like 50% or 45%. Mm. But right now, it's 10%.
Mm.
Or at least this year, it was the lowest that it's ever been. 9 out of 10 people will not get it. So I think, like, the biggest pitfall is that it's based on lottery. It's based on random selection. It's not mm-hmm. even based on, say, merit or the fact that certain people in certain industries get preference. I think that's the biggest pitfall, which is why people are looking to other options. And there's not many other options. And this is where, you know, the what best fits your needs come into play, because the option that Samir and I talk about in the book, which I think is gravely underutilized, the O-1. So O-1 is an extraordinary ability visa. It's still a temporary visa, not a green card. You know, like the H-1B, it's a temporary work visa that requires employer sponsorship. But the O-1 has so much flexibility. You know, first of all, it's uncapped, unlimited number of visas per year. And it doesn't require a minimum salary, which is great for founders.
Correct.
And it also can be extended forever. So every 3 years, or after 3 years, you have to keep renewing it every year, but you can keep renewing it forever. Whereas the H-1B has a cap of 6 years. So of course, you know, not to make it sound like anyone can get the O-1, because it does have an incredibly high bar, unlike the H-1B. I definitely think more people should be applying for it than they are right now.
Back to H-1s, you know, there's a lot of political controversy in the U.S. about it. And while there is some abuse of the H-1B visa through outsourcing firms who take advantage of the loopholes to reduce salaries for their employees, what can an employee do as a recourse? What should they watch out for to make sure that they are being served as well?
Even just yesterday, I got an email from someone who said that they might be the victim of workplace bullying because of their H-1B visa. I think number one is to not accept any offer from firms that say, hey, we'll get you your H-1B if you pay the entire fee. And this happens a lot because, you know, once again, just even in 2023, of the 780,000 applications, almost half of them were multiple applications. They're duplicates. I think I would recommend people to stay away from such companies, which are generally consulting firms, that reach out and say that you pay us the money and we'll get you the visa. And secondly, if your employer is withholding documents from you, say your like I-797, I think that's the H-1B approval notice, or your pay stubs, or any legal documents, just so that they can keep you on. That would also be illegal, and you know, you should contact a lawyer right away.
Tell me about the other underutilized visas. You talked about the O-1, but there's also the IEP, the L-1.
So the O-1 is pretty similar to the H-1 in what it's meant to do. But then there's also other things like the IEP, as you said. IEP stands for International Entrepreneur Parole. It's not a visa, but it is the closest that we have to what could have been a startup visa. So, you know, there was this whole movement to publish something called a startup visa back in 2013. But with the death of the comprehensive reform bill, the startup visa also went down with it, sadly. Regardless, Obama administration tried to come up with an alternative, which is the IEP. The IEP is meant for founders who want to move to the US and build their company here. It is not a visa, but it'll still give you up to 5 years to stay here and build your company here. You know, it has certain basic requirements, like you should have raised $250,000 from a VC. You should have at least 10% ownership in your company, and so on. Mm-hmm. We talk about this in depth in the chapter, but that is another underutilized path, because as far as I know, and I spoke to someone who is at the USCIS, they shared with me that less than 100 people have actually applied and gotten the IEP so far in the last 2 years. I mean, that's nothing, right? In compared to the hundreds of thousands of people who are actually here who might want to start something. Then there's the L1. I think the L1 is pretty popular, especially for big companies that want to transfer employees across countries. So it's an intra-company transfer visa. And this is what, say, Google uses to move their employees from India to the US. I think where it's underutilized is that L1 can also be used by founders to, let's say, open a new branch in the US if they already have a branch abroad. It does have a really high denial rate, though. I think of all the visas that we looked at in the book, RFE rate of almost 1 in 2, which is insane. One of the other parts which doesn't get talked about that often is the H-1B itself has other variations under it. There is the traditional H-1 that we all know about, but there's also cap-exempt H-1B, which is essentially an H-1B that is exempt from the annual cap. So it is only if you're working for a specific set of institutions, like a university, a nonprofit research organization, and so on. But I think for people who are working at these institutions, they don't even have to go through the lottery. They can just get a cap-exempt H-1B, which for all purposes is like the H-1B.
Talking about dependent visas, my partner Mira and I of India Currents have spent the last few years working on stories of domestic violence, especially tied to immigration laws in our community called transnational abandonment. So I'm acutely aware of the pitfalls for spouses on dependent visas when divorce proceedings are started against them and they lose status in this country. What should you take into consideration if you're planning or are married and your spouse or fiance does not have their own valid immigration status in the US? What other options are available for spouses on dependent visas?
Yeah, I'm so glad you covered that. This is not something I thought we'd be talking about in the book when we began outlining the different chapters, but it became pretty clear when I started reading about dependent visas that this is actually a big issue. And
very much,
you know, so, if the statistics, I think somewhere we talk about statistics that 1 in 2 immigrant women at some point go through domestic abuse, some form or other. I think the first recommendation is, please talk to a nonprofit that can help. And I got a quote from Zakia Afrin, who works for Maitri. But, you know, besides Maitri, there's at least 30 other nonprofits that in some way or the other help victims of or survivors of domestic abuse. And they also, besides providing legal support, they also provide emotional support and maybe even housing. But for whatever reason, if that's not possible, I think it's important people know that they have rights and options. For example, in 2017, USCIS published something called the Abused Spouse EAD, H-4 visas. You know, the most common dependent visa is the H-4, which is the dependent visa of the H-1B. And if you're on it, then you generally can get the EAD through the traditional route. But for whatever reason, let's say your spouse is abusing you and you don't want to go and talk to them and be tied to them, you can still go and apply for the Abused Spouse EAD, which I think the only thing it requires from your spouse is their pay stubs or some sort of documentation that they are on an H-1B. And even that, if you don't want to get it through them, you can always, this is a very long process, of course, but go through a court process and subpoena them and get it through a court if you don't want to contact them directly. But that is not tied to your spouse's H-1B, thankfully.
Yeah. Tell me about the other ones, like the O-1, the L-1. Some of them, the spouse can work in the United States. Some they're not able to. So so people have an idea of which ones benefit them and some don't.
Yeah. And, you know, I think in the chapter we have like a table that shows the different spouse visas and which let you work and study. The good news is all of the dependent visas let you study. So you can enroll yourself in a university on them. You can open bank accounts, get a driver's license, etc. But the dependent visa of the F1, O1, they don't let you work. So if you're on an F2, I believe, an O3 visa, which is the spouse visa, you can't work. And this is very frustrating for someone on an O3, especially, because you know, the spouse of someone who is an O-1 holder is probably also extremely qualified and probably have a great career of their own. But the O-3 does not let them work. That is the bad news. I think on the other side, the H-1B, thankfully, the H-4 visa, you can start working on it since 2015. They introduced the EAD program. It's been used by over 200,000 people in the last several years. And the best spouse visa, actually, is the L-1. L-2 spouse visa, it doesn't just let you work. You can actually start working the moment you enter the States along with your spouse. Unlike the H-4, you don't even have to get an EAD. You can just, like, for all purposes, you're like an American citizen. You can do an open work permit. And I think that's one of the pros of the L-1 visa.
How about the IEP?
Yeah, the IEP is also like the H-4, where as an IEP spouse, you have to first get the EAD and then only you can start working. And this is actually a big disadvantage because it can take anywhere from 6 to 9 months to get the EAD card. And with the IEP, every 12 months, you have to kind of leave the country to re-enter it with a stamp, new stamp. So because of this back and forth, you barely get to have a few months to work on it as a spouse.
Moving on to pathways for permanent residency. As you mentioned, the biggest pitfall for Indians is the expected wait times for obtaining a green card on all the employment-based categories is simply 90 years because of that 7% cap. Can you explain the various categories of permanent residency for visas, especially those which are underutilized or even probably unknown by most of us immigrants?
In the book specifically, we cover three pathways, which are all merit-based. So we cover the EB1A, EB1B, and EB2 NIW. I know these are, you know, just numbers for people, but so within the employment-based visas, there's five categories. It goes from EB1 to EB5, and they're in order of preference as well. So the EB1 is called a first preference employment-based green card, where it is set aside for people of extraordinary ability who are at the top of their fields in science, education, business, athletics, and so on. It is a capped visa, though. All EBs are capped because there's only 140,000 EB visas every year. So the EB1 category of the 140,000 gets about 40,000 visas. So of the 40,000, it's allocated between the EB1A, B, and C. I don't know if the EB1A is underutilized because the last few years I've seen a lot of people utilize it since, you know, especially Indian-born immigrants, they are not able to reliably use the EB2 or 3 anymore. So EB2 and 3 are the ones that have a, say, 90-year wait time. Correct. For Indians. So more people are using the EB1 pathway. And it's definitely not as backlogged as the EB2 or 3. But in fact, just in this last month's visa bulletin, it showed that for Indian-born immigrants, the priority date for EB1A is now back to 2012, which, you know, it sounds more alarming than it is, because USCIS themselves said that the priority date should come back to 2022 in a few months. But I think it's caused some panic within the community, thinking that the category that they thought was a faster way to get a green card is also... it's getting more backlogged. That's really it, because more people are applying for it. And so it's just getting more backlogged, but it's not as bad as EB2 or 3.
For Indians specifically, this backlog is very, very frustrating. And then you shared in your book that in 2021, only 45% of the employment-based green cards went to the workers themselves, because the other 55 went to their family members, and the family members are also counted in the 140,000 cap per year. And the worst situation is that because of these backlogs, about 100,000 children who were raised completely in the United States will age out no fault of their own, and might have to leave the country. Given the current political climate where immigration reform is incredibly polarizing and partisan, what do you think is possible by executive action to reform the immigration laws to make it more practical and fair, especially for us Indians, and especially for those who are very entrepreneurial?
I've asked a few people who are in Congress who are working towards policy on the question of what does that look like? What does the future of reform look like? The answer I've got from most of them, if not all, is that any sort of comprehensive reform is non-existent, at least for the next 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. The approach that people are adopting right now is more of a piecemeal approach, trying to focus on just one thing at a time, instead of trying to like snowball reforming both legal and the illegal immigration system at once, which is what has happened in the past and it's never worked. Rather focus on one small problem. And an example of this could be, you know, recently the Biden administration added some 10 or 20 new majors to the STEM designated list, to the list of STEM majors. So this expands the number of people who could get the STEM OPT when they graduate, which adds 2 extra years. And another example could be looking at the O-1 and then make making it easier for founders to apply for O-1s is to add more just regulation around how officers can evaluate founders who apply for O-1s, since traditionally it was not really meant for founders as much. So all these very minor changes that's being taken place right now, I think that's the way to go.
Anything else you want to share that we missed talking about as far as visas? and paths to permanent residency?
I think, you know, people move to America not to move to just America, mm-hmm. but rather they want to move to a better life. Immigration, that's what immigration is for at the end of the day. I immigrated because I wanted high quality education. And I wanted to experience something new. And so I came to the US. I think it's worth for people to think about why they came to America in the first place and to ask themselves if America is still the right place for just their own personal goals in life. And as much as Unshackled is a book about helping people navigate the legal immigration system, I also think it's a book about giving people all of the options at their disposal and helping them make an informed decision, even if that means leaving the US and going somewhere else, which, you know, so the last chapter of the book, we cover the story of someone who went to Canada from mm-hmm. the US because the US was just not serving their dreams anymore. And so I think I just want to remind people of that.
Thank you. Where can we find your book?
Yeah, it's on Amazon everywhere. So people can just go Google it on Amazon and find it there.
Perfect. Soundarya, congratulations on publishing this book, Unshackled, on employment-based immigration. Loved how you use case studies at the beginning of every chapter to make every option more human and relatable. You've done a really fantastic job laying out the non-obvious and underutilized routes that immigrants can use to start companies and achieve freedom through citizenship. Your book offers solutions that, you know, provide some control in an area that offers so little of it, really. I think this will be of great help to many readers of India Currents, and I thank you so much for your time today. Good luck.
Thanks, Anjana. Thanks for the excellent questions. Really appreciate it.